My name is James McMahon. I have obsessive compulsive disorder. Obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, is a mental disorder in which the person has repeated thoughts. They're called obsessions. Or feels the need to perform routines repeatedly. They might be internal or external. They're called compulsions. To an extent that generates distress or impairs general functioning. I've had it for over 20 years. Not that I knew the name for what was happening to me during that time. We call OCD the Downing disorder. It's much misunderstood. Treatment is hard to come by. Anyone tuning in from the UK will be aware of the crisis point that mental health services hit some time ago. But if you can access treatment, it can be effective. I'm on a journey. I was first diagnosed in 2008 at the age of 28. I rejected the diagnosis. My flat was messy, the dirty dishes piled high in the sink. I didn't have OCD. 10 years later, I had what may have been a breakdown. I fought for another diagnosis. I got it. I've had some treatment now, the gold standard, cognitive behavioural therapy and ERP. That's short for exposure response prevention. But I need more, so much more. My condition has come close to ruining my life, even taking it from me, and I'm far from recovered. Sometimes I'm not sure I ever will be, but I'm in the fight. The OCD Chronicles started life as a website, a place to share OCD stories, somewhere to cheer on other sufferers and fight misinformation. And it's a podcast now, and it exists to do the same thing. But I also want to chart my own story. I want to be better, so badly I want to be better. I'll introduce you to the people I meet on this journey. Mental health professionals, researchers, other sufferers. It would mean the world to me if you joined me. On this episode of the OCD Chronicles, I catch up with cartoonist Jason Adam Katzenstein, who I first spoke to for the OCD Chronicles website way back when. Jason does cartoons for The New Yorker. If you're into cartoons, I am. That's a really big deal. But he also recently released his illustrated OCD memoir, Everything Is an Emergency. That's a brilliant book. Jason is a fascinating guy. I'm so pleased he agreed to come on this podcast. We had a chat for the OCD Chronicles website, but I was so taken with your book, and I am unquestionably a frustrated cartoonist, that I thought that it would be really great to have a chat face-to-face across the pond.
Yeah, okay. I'm Jason Katzenstein. I'm a cartoonist and comedy writer for... I make work for The New Yorker. I used to write and draw a bit for Mad Magazine, RIP. I write some television comedy. It's all under the banner, really, of comics, cartooning, comedy writing.
Before we get to the heavy stuff, tell me a bit about your way into drawing art, cartooning.
It's something I've always done. My family was quite encouraging. I always loved Mad Magazine and Spider-Man. Those were my twin loves when I was quite young. And I used to draw caricatures of my friends in school, or I would draw Pokemon for everybody to impress people. And it was a good, like, precocious kid thing to do. I was always very small, and so it could be impressive when I drew a little bit above my age level, but I was also quite serious about it. I was always doing it. I had a pretty linear career trajectory in that I, from a young age, this was just the one thing that I always wanted to do. So I feel really lucky that I get to do it for a job. And I also feel like, oh, I've been training for this forever.
Yeah, no, totally. So you don't feel like you had much in the way of rejection?
Yeah, in a sense, there wasn't that much. Well, I got some work when I was still in college, which was really nice. But The New Yorker is rejection every week. You pitch you pitch a batch of cartoons, and if you're lucky, you sell one. But for the most part, you usually sell none. And that's kind of the story of pitching anywhere, is that it's mostly rejection. It's a whole lot of radio silence. And with TV comedy, even more so, it's a whole lot of let's have a meeting about having a meeting. But so there's a lot of rejection baked into the process. As far as getting into cartooning, I feel very lucky in that I had a supportive family and that I had a little bit of a runway, because I was working when I was still a student. And so it felt like a tenable thing. I don't know. My family always made it no secret that, oh, you love this, you can do this. And also, I think it's important to make explicit in any story like this. Also, my parents paid for me to go to college, and I had bar mitzvah money. And they always, I think that the stakes were always, oh, if I really mess up, I can move back in with my family. And so it gave me a lot of protection to really try and strike out on my own doing this thing. But it is a privilege that I understand is afforded to few, and I had it. But if anybody ever asked me about, like, how do I make it as a cartoonist, I kind of have to say, like, I have rich parents, and that really helped me, and I'm under no illusions that this is just a bootstrap story.
I really appreciate that. It is important to assess our privilege when we're telling our stories, because I do think that people need an accurate idea of what it takes and what people's fallbacks are. So, no, that was appreciated.
I guess I don't, this isn't even a, I'm not patting myself on the back here. It's more because it's such an untenable career path. Right now, I mean, The New Yorker is the only game in town, and there's no job security in that. So it's something where, I mean, the way I do it is I make books, I do TV stuff, I teach undergrad, I pitch New Yorker cartoons, et cetera, et cetera. I'm doing 100 things, and I couple those together, and it constitutes an income, but I don't want to scare anybody away from doing freelance cartooning ever, because it is the best job in the world and I love it. Nor do I want to, create any illusions that it's something where there's much stability or there's one path or an easy path. So I don't even say this to be like, wow, like, please congratulate me for checking my privilege or whatever. I more just want to not lie to people, because I do want to see this next generation of cartoonists out here, and I want to be genuinely helpful in talking about how to get there.
Yeah, no, totally. No, I think I meant it more, I'm from a shitty village in a very run-down, neglected part of the north of England, and I was obsessed with the idea of becoming a music journalist, and people like me just didn't become music journalists. So the idea of doing it was pretty insurmountable when I look back at it. And I think that the landscape is, for working class people, more challenging than it would have been 25 years ago, whenever I was a kid having the idea at school. And I always say to people who want to break into the industry how difficult it is, the challenges, just to be realistic with them. But my view is always, if they want to do it, they're going to do it.
And they should.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, one life and all that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I never wanted to be like the professor who was like, raise your hand if you want to do this. Well, of the people raising their hand, only two are going to blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, fuck it, man.
Absolutely. Going back to the pitching thing, because this is kind of where I was going to get to. So, you know, my livelihood relies on generating ideas and communicating those ideas and pitching them and hustling, and it's a difficult way to make a living. And my OCD is unquestionably attached to the process of pitching and rejection, and what does that rejection mean. And I think I could have picked an easier career path, but people who know me and they understand OCD say that they're quite confident that if I had worked in a supermarket stacking shelves, my OCD would have found a way into that. But I guess what I wanted to ask was, how do you find the experience of rejection?
Strangely, I have managed, for the most part, with exceptions I'm down to go into, to keep at an arm's length some of my more destructive anxieties and OCD tendencies and my work, which is to say, maybe it's a separating my sense of my ego from the work. I've always just, which I'm sure that's not exactly true. I do think that rejecting the work feels different than rejecting me. And also, I've always romanticized, really mythologized this career. And that means I've been a big nerd and I've read every cartoonist account of, oh, and I pitched and was rejected here, and rejection is part of the job. And I went to comic conventions and ask pros to criticize my portfolio. And I've always been like, don't hold back. No, I want it. I want it all. This is only about being a better artist. And so I don't tend much to take that rejection personally. And the exception about when OCD has come for my work has had more to do with thinking about how my work is received or how it affects people. But as far as the sort of backstage part, the pitching part, I've not ever made that association of rejecting the work is rejecting me, or, you know, turned it into an OCD sort of yearning for certainty, chasing forever this idea of like, unless I'm, you know, until I'm not rejected, like I'm not good, or whatever the OCD thought might be. I mean, well, I should ask you more. What for you is the OCD association with rejection?
Well, it's interesting, actually. As you were talking, I had a little bit of clarity in what you just asked. I'm not sure before I asked the question, I could have probably told you exactly what the connection is with me. I think that a lot of my stuff is about shame. There was a lot of it in my family when I was growing up, and therefore there was a lot of rumination around that. And there was also a lot of, I mean, regular listeners to this podcast will know a bit of this, but there was a lot of kind of wariness of the world from my parents. And I mean, looking back, not that any of us really know where this stuff comes from, but I can take a stab at my problems are a consequence of factors in my upbringing. You know, it doesn't take too much of a leap to say that. And I think that actually what I've just thought is, you immediately said about the separation of you and your work, whereas I feel like in my profession, so much of it is about the byline. It's about who I am as a person. And I am absolutely obsessed with a fear of being shamed, or the fear of people not liking me, or the fear of people thinking bad of me. So therefore, pitching is almost, I mean, it's almost, you could argue, a compulsion, because I'm looking for the reassurance of, yes, we like your piece, do some work for us.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. And I'm also realizing as we speak that the work has always felt to me like a place where I can go when I don't want to hang out with myself, or when I want to work through things in this lateral place, this place next to myself, where I can take autobiographical material, but the rules are different than the rules I impose upon my own life. And it's weird, because I do a lot of autobio work. I made a memoir. And yet when people, I've read some scathing reviews of the memoir on goodreads.com, the best worst place to go if you want to have every terrible suspicion you ever had about your work confirmed. And I just don't know how to take it personally, even when it's literally about me. And that to me, I think is the meditative oasis of making this work.
I don't really understand. I mean, I don't really have to go to Goodreads very often, but I'm not really sure what a legitimate criticism of your memoir would be. What kinds of things do people say?
Oh, well, in every comic I've made, there are criticisms of the art, which I get that. I'm probably my own worst critic of my art. And also, your mileage may vary. That's just going to be a taste thing. Everybody hates some kind of art. And so, you know, I'll rack up a bunch of that. And then I don't want to, like, call out individual comments here. I'm trying to think of...
Unquestionably, it is a very authentic piece of work, though.
Thanks, I hope so. I was trying. I mean, this is the first book that I've written and drawn myself, and I was trying to be as honest as possible. Not even honest in terms of plot, but honest where it was like, look, I am an expert on very few things. My own life better be one of them, and I'm just going to try and appraise as truthfully and as sensitively as I possibly can just what this is like at any given moment for me, and put it out into the world.
Yeah, well, you know, fuck those guys. What was the motivation behind making the book? What did you want to get out of it?
Well, so this is something that I think is really lovely that I've discovered listening to your show from guests, and something that you said yourself, which is there's a whole lot of people putting creative work out there saying this is for my younger self, which is exactly how I feel. When I was diagnosed, I read testimonials that freaked me out. I thought of recovery in a way that's completely different from how I think of recovery now. And I just didn't have a story that really was a catalyst for me to try and work on myself and get better. So I decided to make it. In fact, when I started the book, I was in a pretty deep hole. And I thought by making this book, it would be extra motivation to get better, because I always have taken my art seriously, way more seriously than I've taken myself. I thought, what if I make this book and it's about recovering from OCD? Maybe I will finally, in good faith, work on recovering from OCD. And then I'll have this book to give my 15-year-old self when I got diagnosed, but really to, you know, to other 15-year-olds, to other people who are first learning about what OCD is, and tell a story about how it is certainly the biggest challenge in my day-to-day life, but also what a recovery story looks like, also how sometimes it can be kind of hilarious or ridiculous. And I think most importantly, that you're not alone.
I sometimes wonder whether it's actually been my work that has, whilst there's lots of ways that OCD has weaved its way into my work, I sometimes wonder whether actually the desire to make good work is the thing that has kind of kept me buoyant during the most difficult of times. Because I do have a way, I'm saying this because I wonder whether it's the same for you, but I do constantly find a way when I am facing difficulty to weave that into my work, if that makes sense. So I have some eating disorder stuff, and it's quite a new diagnosis for me, and it's very, very connected to the OCD. And I will make cartoons about it, and I don't want to be as trite as to say, oh, it really helps, you know, like the treatment helps, but there is this way that if I draw it, then I'm moving forward rather than being in it, if that makes sense.
That absolutely makes sense. There was, when I was doing ERP work, where you were supposed to perform, you know, where you did your exposure and then you were supposed to delay the compulsive behavior. I touched the dirty thing and I want to wash my hands. And instead of either saying, you're forbidden, or from just doing it, it's wait 15 minutes and then do it. And in the ERP instructions, I was supposed to do something for 15 minutes that calmed me and centered me and felt safe. I would make comics about OCD, and I put them on Tumblr. And that was my first foray into making work about OCD, but I did it in those 15-minute intervals, because I also think that creative work is another way to take back a sense of control in a world of entropy. And so OCD is, you know, the brain, the body making a good faith effort to try and control things that are uncontrollable. And what is art making, if not that also?
Yeah, certainly. I think taking back control in a world of entropy, it sounded like some sort of art punk band from the noughties there.
I've been reading a lot of Mark Fisher.
Right, okay. No, it makes sense. It makes sense.
Yeah.
Going back a sec, in terms of the book, has it had the response that you would have envisaged, or did you not envisage what the response would look like?
I have had a lot of conversations with strangers who responded to it. What I was afraid of was that people with OCD specifically would read it and go, this is not my experience. This doesn't look like OCD, or I don't know what this guy has. I mean, one of the things is like the fear that that all of us has, everyone with OCD all the time, of we'll expose this thing and somebody will be like, that's actually not OCD. That's actually... you're genuinely a freak or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have had a lot of really great conversations with strangers who are at different stages of recovery, people who have not gone into therapy or who are considering trying medication for the first time or have grappled with it for years and are in a hole. And it's really edifying to talk to them and to have this book feel like the bridge where we can meet and start to talk about this thing. Because, and there's another thing that I hear on your show that rings so true. Like I have this discomfort about, I love your disclaimer too. I have this discomfort about, I'm not a professional. I'm not a doctor. I can talk about my own experience, but I'm not qualified to tell somebody like, oh, you should take 0.5 milligrams of, you know, that's not something that I can do. But for me, the most helpful moments in my recovery path, and when I say recovery, I don't mean I'm better. I was sick and now I'm well, but I have a more dynamic understanding of recovery than I did, which I'm down to get into. But it's always been finding community and where I have this impulse to retreat and to get in the fetal position and to be in the corner and to shut everybody out. It's really been group therapy or a friend who really cares about me, or even I found this chat room when I was in a hole one time, an OCD chat room. It's always been this turn outward and toward community that has been the most helpful for me. And it really is a community, and it really is. I feel so grateful that I've found people to talk to, and it sucks that we all have this thing, but it's great that we can talk to each other about it and also understand a little bit more about how the gears of the brain are grinding for each other. And so I mean, tell me what you think. I mean, I know that for me, with the people closest to me, I've also had to figure out how to ask for help. Like I've had to learn different ways to ask for help that aren't asking for reassurance.
Well, it's interesting. The one thing I do want to jump in with that you just said, when we talk about the community, I always describe it as a shitty club, but I like everyone in it. Mm-hmm. And when I found my support group, that was like, I don't know, I felt like some sort of Southern Baptist child, you know, being dipped in the lake. It was really like a rebirth. So many things started to make sense. I was just spun around and put in the direction I needed to be in. Like, a lot of hard work has followed and it is going on now, but I was completely lost before I found them. So yeah, you're totally right about community. I think that for me, I found my wife, and I'm always really conscious when I talk about the importance of my wife to my experience of OCD, because saying, oh, I needed this person, or this person was the calming influence on my life I needed. I mean, like, those things aren't very sexy, So I always feel like I need to quantify that my wife is really sexy, but she really was the difference. She was obviously into me enough to research what OCD was when I was still, when I met her, I was still, God, I was 5 years after my first diagnosis, which I ignored, but I knew something was wrong still. So on early dates, I would say that I had an OCD diagnosis, but I wasn't completely bought into it. So, you know, she kind of really kind of made the effort, but I think a big part of it was her personality just gelled so well with mine. Like she worries, you know, I mean, everyone worries. It's a human experience, but she's the least irrational person I've ever met. So she's very, very good at being the barometer that sometimes I don't have. You know, I've got a mum who has been with me all the way through on this, really. I mean, that's the nature of mums. But in terms of me getting a diagnosis, ignoring the diagnosis, having breakdowns, really being at rock bottom, she's always been there, like cheerleading. And then when I found out this was OCD and I found out what I needed to do, she came with me on that. So again, you know, if we're talking about privilege, I am really lucky in that regard. I think the main thing for me was, I'm not sure I totally had the problem asking for help. I've always been lucky enough that I've been able to verbalize how I've been feeling. That's never really been a problem. I've never really been kind of, I guess, what some men are accused of being quite shut off. That's not really the case. But I guess that I also think as well that I was very suspicious of mental illness. I mean, I only really realized this recently, but one of my biggest obsessions for a long time was that people would think that I was mental, you know, and I was mental. Like, I was working in an office and obsessing that everyone thought I was, insert whatever terrible thing you want there. And I was going home at night and basically locking myself in my room because it was just easier than hanging out with people and therefore being triggered by what they might think of me. And I was creeping out of the house at midnight to burn all my clothes because I thought they were contaminated, you know. So I was mental, but the idea of being mental, and again, you know, regular listeners to this podcast will know that I'm saying mental in a very affectionate way and not as a judgment. There was obviously on some level part of me that was uncomfortable with the reality of the situation. But I don't know, man. Like, I feel a little bit, there's been a part of me recently that has tried to see the world less in terms of absolutes and also see myself less in terms of absolutes. And really go a little bit more towards the idea that the world is chaos, which ultimately I think has been very helpful to me because it comes back to we can't make ourselves completely safe. We can't predict the future. We can't, because all those things were, you know, were making me ill.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. And I think that's very not OCD. To embrace the chaos of the universe.
I am really trying. I do this other podcast called The Spook Podcast, and it's about weird stuff, Bigfoot, aliens, true crime, all that sort of stuff. And I was interviewing a guy the other day who was explaining to me a lot about the recent UFO disclosures. And I know that at one point in my life I would have been listening to it and thinking, I need to start digging an underground bunker and I need to start stockpiling and, oh my God, they're going to turn me into the aliens are going to come and they're going to turn me into a burger. And I was just listening to it just going, ah, well, I'll enjoy today. And I was thinking that's so far away from where I was. You said something before about recovery and you were like, oh, we can go into that a bit. And I've become a little bit uncomfortable with the word recovery. Tell me what you meant a little bit by that.
Well, I think it actually dovetails nicely with what you just said, because there is a kind of zero-sum black and white rigidity thinking that I think is quite common with the OCD brain. And when I was first diagnosed, and one thing I learned was, oh, this doesn't go away, I thought, okay, that's it. there's sick, there's well. I'm always going to be sick. Here are some things that I won't do. I won't be a dad ever. I won't be in a healthy relationship. I won't calm these intrusive thoughts, et cetera, et cetera. And I always thought of recovery or being well or whatever this horizon was as this moment where there were no more intrusive thoughts, there were no more anxieties, where I was never in another hole. And I've learned that it's not going to look like that, but nor does it have to look like I'm always going to feel as bad as I do when I'm in the deepest hole and at the mercy of the most intrusive thoughts or feeling the most, you know, paralysis from whatever compulsive behavior I'm doing. What I've learned is that it's not about never having another intrusive thought. It's about having an intrusive thought, and instead of having that be the thing you wrestle with all day, being able to, as I've learned in a group that I've been in, render it irrelevant.
Yeah, no, totally. It's interesting you say that, because I've been thinking about that recently and about how with the treatment I've had, which isn't loads at all, I need more and hopefully it's coming soon, but I am really good now at batting away new intrusive thoughts. Mm-hmm. The ones that I struggle with are the ones that have been there a long time and before I got diagnosed and started having treatment. Like, I can suddenly think, my God, what if I'm racist? Mm-hmm. And I can go, oh, OCD is ridiculous, go away. And that's that. And it doesn't plague me beyond a little wrinkle, but it's the ones from before that I think that are quite embedded and I need to dig them out. I think the thing with the idea of recovery is I have had conversations with people who say, oh, I have recovered from OCD, and mm-hmm. it seems really nice. I'm just not sure I believe them. I think that, but you know, who am I to judge what's inside someone's head? But I definitely know people with OCD who I knew in the pits of despair, and they are living good lives. And I think that that's the thing that makes me go, there's nothing especially unique about, I think OCD is like, you said that thing before about how we all think, oh, maybe we're going to be exposed and we don't actually have OCD. Also, I think there is something in, certainly in myself, that we think, oh, well, CBT and ERP, it's not going to work on me. And I think OCD is trying to tell you that you are more unique than you actually are.
Yeah. Okay. I was reading this mental health newsletter, Mental Health, HELLTH, by P.E. Moskowitz, and they were talking this week about egg theory, which is a subset of queer theory, and specifically about trans folks who, there's this kind of pessimism pre-transition of this voice in your head saying, it is impossible for me to do this. And you look back at that, and you see that pessimism I don't want to butcher. This was P. Moskowitz's piece, and then referencing a piece by Grace Lavery that I'm also in the middle of right now. But I do think that, yeah, I don't know. I feel humbled the older I get before the abundance of evidence that, like, whatever thing that I think makes me special and like, oh, this thing that worked on everyone won't work on me. I got my tonsils zapped and they gave me the, the little IV that put me to sleep. And I just remember telling them that it wasn't going to work on me while falling asleep. And yeah, ERP's pretty amazing. It's pretty effective.
Yeah. Yeah.
As far as recovery from OCD or saying I've recovered, I mean, I think it's called OCD when it interrupts your life, when it ruins the party for you. But I think that the tendency to have irrational thoughts or the impulse to do things that don't make much sense, and you forge these connections in your brain that if I do this, this will happen, is, I think that's just a human thing to do. And so if it's in a place where it's not wrecking your day, it might not even be the most relevant part of your day. That's incredible. But as long as we're talking about shades of gray here, OCD doesn't, it doesn't feel to me like, oh, like there's a graph and at this point exactly you call it OCD, right? It's like, if this diagnosis is helpful to understand like the extremes that your brain is going to, great. And then if you get to a place where you're still doing little things, but it doesn't necessitate like feeling like this diagnosis, like that's awesome too. You know, I have a friend who's an addict, and I think, I mean, I've had discussions with him about sort of the overlap in the AA program and in a lot of OCD group, and understanding just the fluidity of this boundary, and talking about yourself in an addict in the present tense, or talking about having OCD in the present tense, about, yeah, I don't know. I mean, everybody has their thing to.
Yeah, no, totally. You just referenced the mental health newsletter. Which I subscribe to as well, and I think I came to it via you, actually. I think you'd shared it on Twitter, and I thought that's definitely worthy of my Patreon or whatever it is, Substack. And I regularly have my mind blown by it. I will quite often disagree vehemently, but that's sort of the point, you know,
like. Yeah.
But I do think some of the takes on it are really, really provocative in a good way. And I guess it's that thing of you've just almost said what I've interpreted it as is, you know, when does OCD start and where does it end in a way? That's kind of it really, isn't it? And I do think the thing with OCD that is different to the desperation that many people feel, and it's no judgment, because I think that when you feel desperate, you are looking for certainty. I think one thing that makes OCD different from people looking for a label for themselves is that it is, as much as we don't know about OCD, we know that it is a thought process which is wonky, or it's wrong, or it doesn't work, you know? So I think as a description of symptoms, it's really good. But it is also that thing of, I am completely accepting now that there isn't going to be a day where I was what I was, inverted commas, before OCD. And I'm not even totally sure I would want to be now. I would want to be free from OCD, but I'm pretty happy with a lot of the other stuff.
That's great. That's a great place to be.
Yeah, totally. Let's end this with you, though. So I really love the memoir. I think that it is what you say you intended it to be, which is, it would be something that it would be a voice for the voiceless, to use a slightly sort of cheesy term. And that's definitely what I think I'm trying to do. So yay us. But do you think that story is finished, or would you revisit it?
Great question. You know, I got a dog during the pandemic, and I feel like there are a lot of stories to tell about dogs and OCD, both as a trial by fire for contamination fears, but also because training a dog is not dissimilar from doing ERP work. And so I've been thinking about what would that book look like. As far as an OCD story, I mean, there's also a lot of really interesting conversations that I've had with folks with OCD about the pandemic and interactions between OCD and that. I mean, maybe some of this also just has to do with my ambivalence about doing something as crazy as making a memoir that I wrote when I was 28 and 29. Hopefully there's more to the story. Hopefully I have more insights. I continue to think about this stuff and experience it. And certainly a lot of my dogmas have been punctured. I think that the part that I'm least satisfied with in the book is that I only begin to untangle questions about the dance between my OCD and my creativity. And so that's a thread that I would want to further explore. I think that I just don't know enough about what I think about this stuff yet, and so I have to ask more questions and learn more.
OCD Chronicles is brought to you by sufferers of OCD, not mental health professionals. This is a place to educate and inform from a perspective of lived experience, but not to advise. Thankfully, the United Kingdom is lucky enough to have two great charities for OCD and their related disorders. One is called OCD UK, the other OCD Action. I personally have found them hugely helpful in my long and storied journey with this wretched disorder. You can find them easily enough online. Solidarity with sufferers. OCD is hell, but there is help. The OCD Chronicles is brought to you by James McMahon. That's me. It's a Spook Media production. Until next time.